Welcome to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. Today I'm chatting with artist and embroiderer Richard McVettis. Richard, thank you for joining us on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast. First question is, tell us what you do.
So I'm an artist and I work primarily with textiles, but everything I do is really intrinsically linked to process, so making. I'm a maker and an artist all in one. Everything that sort of drives my practice is about repetition, about process. And I've become known for specifically hand embroidery. I mean, that's the thing that everyone sort of knows me for. And that's the bit that sort of drives my practice, is this the endless sort of possibilities and potential of hand embroidery to do all these wonderful things. Yeah. And about expression through stitch as well.
Yeah. And that's how that's how I got to you, because I, as we said earlier, I did one of your workshops online during COVID and was really intrigued at the work and the patience. And we were talking earlier about patience. I mean, how long does it take you to do a piece typically?
Yeah, I think my practice is a practice of patience. And then the first thing you would see in a lot of my work is that presence of time, because it takes time to make the work. So a lot of the work is really about the honesty of labor in materials. And so many of my works, like some pieces, they might take, you know, my longest piece of work maybe has taken me 5 years to make, and maybe it's not finished. So there is a lot of patience required in thinking about my work and sort of thinking about long-term plans of my work. But because I've done it for so long, I know that sometimes it's worth that time. There is an investment in there, and there is a sort of value in that. And that idea of slowness is probably the most important thing as well.
Do you think of yourself as a craftsman?
Yeah, this is a tricky question. I think I'm a craftsman, but I'm also an artist. I'm also a textile artist. I'm also an embroiderer. I think I'm happy with whatever people want to call me. And I sit on this very fine line between fine art and craft. And I think it's much more blurry. And I think that's the most interesting part to be sometimes, is that I can straddle lots of different worlds all at the same time. I can be designing something. I can be in a gallery, but also, I can also be crafting something. But I think when it becomes more than craft is when it has, like, I'm not just doing it to be good at it. Like, that's important. And I do really good stitching. I think I am a good embroiderer. But that was not always my aim. My aim was all about mark making, was about drawing. And so those were the important things. What my aim was never to be the best embroiderer in the world. Otherwise, I would be doing all the other stitches. You know, I practice one or two stitches. So to call myself an embroiderer, I think would maybe disservice all the other people who are really highly skilled at all those other crafts as well. Like, I'm a bit of a lazy stitcher. Like, I don't follow the embroidery rules so much. So I feel, it's sort of a blurry line, I think.
When you think about luxury, and we're obviously going to talk a bit more about luxury, I mean, the thing we think about is, well, I certainly think about is patience and the crafts, the skill that goes into making something. Mm-hmm. And that's really why I asked you about being a craftsman. And you're talking about, you know, spending a lot of time on making things. Mm. When you think about luxury, if you think about luxury, do you think about time and space and how long it might take you to make something? Or
yeah, I mean, that's always, I think in a world of scarcity, I think, and other priorities, like the cost of living, food and shelter, I think sometimes like art can come off as a luxury, but I've never thought of myself as making luxury goods or luxury products. It tends to fall into that bracket because people can afford it, because there are lots of attributed costs like time and labor, right? Because that's where a lot of my work is about the labor and how much we value someone's time to make something. But I think I don't really want to see art as a luxury, because I feel like art is democratic and I feel like everybody should have access to art, because the benefits of art are more than just a luxury product for someone who can afford it. And so when I'm like teaching workshops, which are much more affordable, or I'm making work and I'm putting it out there into the world, my job as an artist is to inspire, to educate, to change perspectives. And I don't think that should be a luxury. But in a world where people don't have a lot of bandwidth, they don't have time because they're working all the time and they can barely make a living, then I think sometimes it does become a luxury to think about all those, the niceties of life, like taking beauty in the everyday or so, you know, in a lot of my work and especially through social media, I'm trying to share my perspective or ways to look at the world in a very different way so that I can sort of bring a slight bit of joy to that. A lot of my work, I would say some of my work pushes it into a luxury bracket, but I don't think about market. Like I've never thought of myself as a person making a good for luxury market, but it just tends to fall in that because that's what people can sort of afford, or those people are in an area where they can spend more money on art. But
because I mean it's interesting, you know, often we in the modern age, or today we think about luxury and we think about fashion, and you think typically it's around fashion and marketing and these big, you know, big brands who are selling their stuff. And you've spoken about something that's quite different in terms of luxury. You're talking about, you know, you mentioned scarcity, you're talking about time to make something, you talk about accessibility. Do you think that those are the things that define luxury? You know, the scarcity, the time, the accessibility. Is that what do you think luxury might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I think luxury is relative, right, to a person and time. And so I think a luxury for me is to have a whole day in the studio where I'm not worrying about how I'm going to pay the studio rent or something like that. So I think luxury is perspective. And I don't think everyone aspires to what like big fashion houses are trying to push out at you, which are goods. And I would question whether some of that is luxury now. And I think fashion brands are definitely thinking about that because a lot of the fashion brands are now targeting sort of more accessible sort of products, right? Collaborations with street brands. So I think it's different. And I think if I think about luxury, I think about ethics, I think about sustainability, I think about all these other things. So it's much more about the story now and people buying into, and I think as an artist, people are buying into the story that you're creating, which is what sort of brands try and do as well. They're trying to sell you a lifestyle, a story. But I'm not trying to do that. I'm just, for me, it's just, I'm trying to express myself. In the world,
But that could be seen to be the luxury.
And I do feel like that because I'm from a very working class family, and my dad was a coal miner, my mom worked in a factory. No one was making art at home, and because they were exhausted because they were working with their hands all day. So why would they come home and like draw a picture or paint a picture or something like that? Whereas you know some of my other family who were very creative. And they worked in the mines, had to create. I mean, creativity is it's human, right? To want to create. And so I don't necessarily think that's luxury, but I think the way life is for a lot of people, it's a luxury to think in that way. Yeah.
Sure. What excites you?
I mean, I'm excited by a lot of things. I mean, just walking around the streets and seeing like random everyday things, like the mundane, like just a chance encounter of materials or light or shadows or compositions, those sort of things. I think that sort of the beauty of the day, of every day, the beauty of process of making. There's a really beautiful film called Perfect Days, a guy in Tokyo cleans toilets. And that film was like really beautiful because he was asking you to question the everyday and take joys out of the simplicity of life, not to aspire. Like people always want more and more and more of a certain thing. And it's like, it's about status, right? Isn't it? If you've got something, then it becomes sort of virtue signaling, or it's about showing your status as a person in society. It's like, I've got this new bag or I've got this new car. I think younger people are thinking less about that now. I'm not on sort of TikTok and all those places for sure, but I do think there is a slight sort of shift in the perception of what we think luxury is. Yeah.
And does that, I mean, you're walking around town, how does that inspire you? And then how does it manifest itself in your work?
Yeah, I mean, I take a lot of photos And I might not look at a photo for maybe 2 or 3 years. So I keep a really good sort of diary of those things. And they affect me subconsciously, I think. A lot of my work is inspired by the grid, you know, the grid of the city, of intersections of roads, road signs. I mean, right behind you, I've got two sandbags, which are inspired by sandbags that I'm seeing around the city. So, you know, I don't think those are of those as a luxury item, but they're just a way to try and express my world and translate it. So a lot of this stuff is about composition. It's about space, formal qualities of sort of art. And I translate that, you know, through mark or through the use of space, any way of sort of transforming that into my way, I think, yeah, my language.
What is mark making for you? Because mark making is something, you know, you'd normally attribute with graffiti.
Yeah, it? Or drawing. Drawing. So any way of making a mark, so making a mark on a piece of fabric with some thread, or drawing, or any way of sort of using my hand to manipulate a fabric and create, you know, a lot of the work is about presence, about trace, evidence that you were there. So a lot of these things, they think like, you know, what I love more than anything is maybe even on the tube, you know, the way things wear away. In Japan, it's called wabi-sabi. So this evidence of time through materials, of things in constant motion. So that's the bit that really excites me, is that that's why I like sandbags and road signs, because they speak of a city in motion, this sort of language of time happening. And why shadows really excite me as well, is that it shows that you're part of a bigger system, that you are on a planet rotating around a hot ball of sort of gas, right? So those sort of things really inspire me and sort of humble me, I think, as well.
Yeah. And then how does that come out in your work?
Yeah, so I might take motifs, so like the grid of something. Yeah. And also I'm thinking about, you know, making work for me is, especially when I'm embroidering, because it's such a meditative state, it becomes a sort of facilitator of thought. So when I'm doing, you know, making the work, I'm thinking about all these ideas. So a lot of my work is very, looks sort of microscopic or macro. So I'm looking, you know, a lot of my work looks like planetary systems or maps or solar systems, or sometimes they look like things underneath a microscope. So it's about perspective and scale. And so, you know, some of it is, sometimes it's very abstract and sometimes it's very, you know, representational. I've gone slightly more abstract as I've got older. So the world has got slightly more complicated, as it always does when you get older, right?
Yeah. And that's reflected in the work.
Yeah, I think so.
And you can track.
Yeah, I think, absolutely. Over 20 years I've been making work. You can, I mean, they're very subtle changes. And when they're in sort of in hindsight and you can see a nice clear timeline, you can see how the work has sort of changed. Yeah.
Do you think of yourself as an innovator?
I don't think I'm innovating at all, because I mean, what I'm using here, maybe I'm challenging the definition of embroidery, or I've been trying to challenge the definition of embroidery, both as an art form, as something more than just a sort of decorative element. And of course, it is, a lot of my work is about aesthetics, so that is really important to me. But also, I'm trying to deal with like the human condition, okay, what it is to be human, to make sense of the world. That is what's really exciting about me. But I don't think I'm innovating. I'm part, you know, I'm inspired by all the other people that have been before me, you know, and nothing is truly original. I mean, I don't think it is. And what's great about hand embroidery is that I can add my own flair. I mean, this was inspired by this seeding stitch that I've become sort of known for. I saw this in the V&A, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, it's not the same, absolutely, because I saw it and took it and went for it, you know. Yeah. But that was the starting point. So it was already out there. It just, we're all very individual people. And so I add my own sort of personality onto that. So a lot of us take things and then we transform it and it sort of slowly grows. But I don't think I'm not innovating. I'm not coming up with a new material. A lot of the ideas that I'm thinking about are things that other people think about all the time, right? Yeah. Existential things about what it is to live in a world like this. So I don't think I'm innovating. I think that would be quite a bold statement for me to make, yeah.
But isn't it innovative? Isn't the approach innovative?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Maybe that is it. I'm trying to be.
I don't want to make you an innovator. Yeah, but
Make me an innovator. Yeah. I mean, if that, I like that as my byline. Innovator.
Innovator and alchemist.
I feel like innovator is always someone who's making something much more sort of useful. Like
right.
that would. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I've never been thought of it as an innovator, but I mean, I'll take it.
You spoke about Japanese. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned two things related to Japan.
Mm.
One is the film,
yeah,
and then the other is the remaking.
Yeah.
Are you inspired? Does Japanese art and craftsmanship inspire you?
I've never been to Japan. I would like to go, but I think I am. I think I'm inspired by their relationship to time, and basically because they, you know, you have the cherry blossom, and they're really interested in the ephemeral of the moment, and even the way they look at construction and architecture is that they quite readily will deconstruct things and rebuild them, and even in the Shinto, and I can't remember what it's called, the Isa City. You know, there's a process, right, where they deconstruct a temple and rebuild it on the same foundation. So they keep the foundations, but every few years they go a process. So there's this constant cycle and this sort of respect for time. I think that's the bit I really sort of appreciate, that sort of general sense of appreciation of the longevity of time, the sort of infiniteness of it, and then your position within that, I think. The sort of the beauty, again, of the everyday, I think that's really, I think that really excites me.
I want to ask you a bit more about time, because you've spoken about time quite a bit. Do you think time is a luxury?
I do think time, to a certain extent, is a luxury, I think, especially in the world of today. And I think it has been since, the Industrial Revolution, right? When time became sort of more commodified, and the invention of the clock, and where your time became someone else's time. So I do think, you know, the Industrial Revolution sort of has played a damaging role in how we respect people's time, or how we value people's time, and value different people's time, for sure. Like, I'm reading at the moment, you can't see behind me, but it's the sort of the story of the making of the working class, which is, I can't remember the name of the guy who wrote it. It's quite a heavy book. The making of the English working
Thompson.
Class. I just think, and it really starts with the Industrial Revolution, right? And this idea of time being sort of mechanized or colonized, really, against the sort of cycles of nature. Right, because especially with the advent of electricity, we work longer hours, and so we're less in sync with nature because we don't respect the sort of cycles of seasons, and so the world is sort of sped up, right? Yeah. And that is definitely, climate change is a result of a sped up world. We've sped up the process of climate change through, you know, like coal, for instance, the sort of unbreaking, the unlocking of coal in the Industrial Revolution, the unlocking of time, all that time, 300 million years of energy and time unlocked has sped up everything. So we've been able to go beyond the capability of the human body and the hand, right? Because before the Industrial Revolution, everything was much at a slower pace. Mm-hmm. People were paid better, right? I mean, the Industrial Revolution was the start of fast fashion, unsatiable desire for cotton, and so really that is the beginning of this sort of disconnect between how we think about time now and that. And so in my work, I'm trying to, it forces you to slow down because I'm limited by the action of my hand. Like, I can't make my work any quicker, and sometimes I hate it and love it all at the same time. Like, I want to make work quicker because of the ideas that, but then it forces you to stop and think and slow down and have a little bit more empathy for people around you. It's like going for a walk versus sitting on a really high speed train, really blurry out the window, blah, blah, blah. Going for a walk, then you start to see things and you can start to talk, and making, you know, stitching specifically, or any creative process, is a way of slowing down and seeing.
That's interesting, because a lot of people that I've spoken to, when I ask them what their luxury is, they say time.
Yeah.
But it's a completely different interpretation of time.
It's such an abstract idea, right? A concept. And it's the great leveler, okay? Because we're all given a certain amount of time, and we don't know where we are on that sort of scale. But yeah, I do think time is really tricky, especially if you don't, in a world which is facilitated by money, then, and everything costing a lot of money, you sort of, there's a sort of a deal here. And I think at the moment, I think the deal is slightly broken because people don't earn enough, or people are having to work two or three jobs just to maintain one life. So there's a sort of, so there's something quite wrong here in that. So I'm I think about all these ideas of time, absolutely, when I'm working, not just the physical representation of time. So a lot of the work I made previously was about representing time. So every single dot would represent a moment. Okay, so like a comma or a full stop would delineate in a paragraph a moment, you know, a breathing moment. The stitches are meant to represent a lived moment. So I'm just saying, like, I'm here. Yeah. I'm here. So this sort of proclamation of a lived moment, and then I'm sort of trying to make something which is intangible, because it's there, we don't see it, it's very abstract, but then how can I put that into a material form? So a lot of the objects are about making the intangible tangible, like visible. So what can I see? We can see time happens as we get older, but I wanted to show it in a different way.
I mean, it's a really interesting approach, because I wonder if all those people that I've spoken to talk about time think about it in that much detail, or it's about them just being busy.
Yeah.
And that they want to spend more time with their children, for example, or they want to, I don't know, have a walk down the street or go to the park.
Yeah.
And the way you think about it is much more considered, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important part of the ideas that, you know, stitching... How I express the world is through stitch, but I use that as a medium to then explore all the things that really interest me, like how the world is made. And so what are the fundamental things about the world that we know? Like, and so I'm really interested in physics and science and cosmos. So what is time at a quantum level? What is it at a sort of human level? So I'm thinking about time in different perspectives. And what is the long view of time? Like, what can time teach you? What can slowness teach you about long-term thinking? And I think we need that across all sectors, is that it's very, we're very short-termism in this country. And actually the political cycle lends itself to short-term thinking. Whereas I think as a society, we need long-term thinking. And that's not what I'm trying to, and maybe I'm trying to think about it in my work, is that actually sometimes work, this work will take a long time to make.
Yeah.
So I want people to think about time, that there's no immediacy to the work that I make. And I think that's a lesson in life, really.
Do you think people think about that when they see their work?
No, absolutely not. No, I don't think so. It's not always relevant. People, I don't like to tell people so much about the work. It is an important part of the work. The story is for those who want to listen to it. But I think that's why I really, aesthetics is really important to me as well. Like, I want to make beautiful things. I like beautiful things. I like objects. And so that is usually the way that people get into it, and people are interested in the process. But there are different facets of the work. So I think there are different layers of the work that people engage with, and that's absolutely fine. And I don't want to enforce meaning onto it. However, if people ask for more information, like, you know, I will tell them, yeah. Because it's really led by research. Yeah. So I'm reading as much as I'm making, and those two are sort of feeding together.
There's a luxury of making, a luxury of learning. Are you not doing yourself a disservice by not kind of pushing, not necessarily pushing, but pursuing this idea that as part of the craft, it is about time, and all of these things you've described, all the knowledge that you've built, and all the things, the worldly things that are influencing your work, is part of that narrative that the customer or the whatever you call the collector should know about.
Yeah, exactly. And which is why I quite often I wouldn't consider myself as a craftsman, or a craftsperson, because I think it's not just about the skill. And that's what pushes it into this arena of maybe it's more fine art or art. And I'm not saying that other craftspeople don't think about that, because I think people generally do, but I'm not making the same thing over and over again, which I think it's slightly different. So the idea is just as important for me as the making. It's absolutely fundamental that the idea is just as good as the making. And I think if they're not as good as each other, you know, I craft the idea as much as I craft the object as well. Yeah. So both are really, really important to how I think about my practice. Yeah.
But then the craftsmanship is both of those things.
Yeah.
Or craftspersonship, if there's such a word. It's both of the things.
But
it's,
it sort of pushes it into a different realm. And again, it's like, so then it becomes, for me, it's like I'm an artist trying to explore different things. And it becomes more than just about the crafted object.
Sure.
It's about everything else I'm making at the same time. So the problem is that people tend just to see the object, or it becomes like an interior decoration object.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's where art ends up, right? It ends up most of the time in someone's home on the wall. And of course the story is really important. And I would always encourage that story aspect, because that's when it becomes more than just craft.
Yeah.
It becomes, and then, you know, maybe that is the luxury, okay? It's all of this, you know, it's the storytelling, it's the ethics, it's the way of thinking, it's the perspective, all this.
Yeah, the object, it's everything.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was just gonna say, and that's where, we've probably or possibly lost this kind of understanding of what luxury might be, because it's become about a branded experience as opposed to a lived object.
Yeah.
And living through the person who's crafted that object and thought about that object.
Yeah.
Because, you know, branded product is obviously not considered in the same way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you're looking at a piece of art or a gallery or these places, they are moments where you can interact with art and experience some of that. And so the moment you call it luxury, then I feel like it sort of targets the wrong people. But maybe it's the language around luxury that needs to be sort of changed or amended, because I feel like maybe it's a slightly used word of, you know, it's sort of everywhere on billboards or apartments or luxury one bedroom.
Luxury,
but is that about scarcity? Because you can't get a one bedroom. So now it's a luxury to have a home, right? Because I think it is, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this sort of luxury chocolate, I mean, it's like the word craft, you know, it's sort of overused so many different times. So it's become sort of spiel to sort of sell things. But I think it is changing, because people perceive, as I said, it's sort of relative to the person and the time and what they think of.
And I think that's, I mean, that's important, because I think craft is a funny word. And now luxury has also become a really weird word, because, you know, luxury chocolate, luxury tights, luxury, everything's luxury. And in fact, none of it is really luxury. And that's why I'm interested in having these conversations, because everyone's interpretation of luxury is obviously going to be different, or mostly different. But the common theme that through, I don't know, 68 episodes of the podcast, is that luxury, you know, these luxury brands are not really selling luxury. They might be selling premium quality product, but, you know, there's no or very little consideration given to the person making things,
I used to work in retail for a really long time, and part of my job was looking at different types of retail. And so you'd have can I mention brands? I mean, I don't know, like different types of retail. So like premium retail, you'd only show one item, right, on a rail, and that gives this sort of idea of exclusivity, right? But I know in the back there's 100,
right? Absolutely.
And it's this sort of, how are we trying to sell this? That's really interesting. And then you go to Primark and it's stacked up really high. They're just being more honest about the fact. And then what they're trying to do in the premium retail is, it probably maybe made in the same factory or near the same factory, but it's a different. So I mean, there are lots of people interrogating that, and it's not my experience. I don't really know a lot about luxury retail in terms of that way, but how we present it, especially at retail level, is interesting, because I think a lot of it is sort of smoke and mirrors.
Yeah,
it's like what we perceive as luxury is this sort of status item, exclusive, limited edition, all these sort of things. So I think, it's very different to what I perceive as luxury. I don't aspire to
the one bag in the front and 45.
And always I feel like luxury, somebody else is paying for that luxury.
Yeah.
I always think about like really exclusive 5-star hotels, because, you know, they're serviced by people who are probably minimum wage. But so your luxury comes at the expense of somebody working there, and all these sort of piles of towels they have to clean every day. And it's like, so it, again, it's this luxury sometimes comes at the expense of somebody else.
Always.
Yeah. So that's how I think about it. And it doesn't sit really nice with me at all. No. Yeah.
There's an interesting book called Regenerative fashion. I should read.
Yeah.
I mean, I get that notion of, you know, 5-star hotels, you served.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, you can throw your towels on the floor and somebody will pick them up, wash them, mm-hmm. bring them back the next day, change your linen. I quite like having fresh linen every day. But aside
from... it's nice. But then I think about the people who might have saved their whole life to go and experience that. And I'm like, oh, that's really great. I was like, oh, what a great experience that would be for my mom and dad to experience that. That moment where they get their bed made for them every day or they get fresh towels. I mean, that is... And so in some respects, so I have it like I'm sort of... I'm a centrist when it comes to this sort of thing because I've both experienced it. But I can see, but and that's probably the artist, right? Because we can straddle both these worlds.
Yeah.
Is that we can be in this sort of luxury world, but then we can sort of go back to it and we can sort of travel between all of these worlds and see it. And so that's what I'm always sort of thinking from my perspective. But that's that's really dictated by probably my upbringing. And
And most people can't experience that.
Yeah.
I mean, most people don't, you know, they might get the opportunity being part of the workforce, and that's how they experience luxury through somebody else's ability or, you know, financial capacity to be able to go in and spend £20,000 a night on a hotel.
Yeah, which just blows my mind.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then I suppose, I mean, this is a slightly different conversation. I mean, the thing that's interesting about that is that, you know, why would somebody spend even if they could, why would you spend £20,000 on a hotel room when you see what's going on in the world? I mean, you know, look, you know, there are millions of people who do that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, it's relative, right, to whatever money that you might have. Yeah. So 20,000 to me is like
a lot
of money.
Yeah.
But to somebody who has got £1 billion, you know, it's really
that's
nothing.
It's not even the interest
of the day. So I mean, that's just about that's about inequality, right? And you know, that's probably a different conversation.
Yeah, that's the world.
Yeah, but you know, as an artist, I sort of go to all these sort of events and functions where I sort of straddle all of these sort of worlds, right? And it's interesting, yeah, because I can sort of see that perspective, and part of me wants it, and then the other part of me is like, no, you know, because it's, you know, we all want a slightly better life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You've mentioned sustainability, you've mentioned the environment, you've mentioned all of those things in the course of our conversation. What does sustainability mean to you? Does it impact your work? Does it impact the way you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I necessarily touch on sustainability in the most obvious sense, like I'm using cotton and wool, which I don't think is necessarily always sustainable. But for me, it's about sustainable thinking. It's about long-term thinking. It's about thinking about our relationship to the environment. It's thinking about the planet, the materials that we use. So when I think about sustainability, I think like that. I have a small practice. I don't churn out work. Work takes a really long time. I live in a city. I live in a small flat. I vote green. You know, so these are all the things. That's how I think about sustainable. I don't necessarily address it in the most obvious way within my work, although some of my work has been political. I think about the work I made a few years ago, which was called Coal Scenes, and that was really about the relationship between material, so coal as the material, where I charted all of the coal seams that my family worked at.
Wow.
And that really sort of unearthed all these sort of stories about race, about class, about hierarchy, and about how material shapes our lives. So in that way, you can understand, so my work questions this sort of perspective of time. So that here you have coal formed 300 million years ago, and it's still having it's having a huge impact on the world that we live in now, climate, also inequality, areas of the country where, you know, high industrialization, Scotland, you know, the northeast, the northwest, where coal centers were, now don't have any jobs. And it's 40 years since the miners' strike.
Yeah.
I'm 41. And so in 83, my family all up to move to South Africa, where I was born, because there were no jobs in the coal mines. So thinking that, for me, I'm thinking about the relationship between material, between the environment, between land, you know, this idea of, we're sort of migrating, we're sort of nomadic, following where the jobs go. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, I think that is about sustainability and thinking about, you can always see the future of our planet sort of written in the, you know, in the earth, right?
Yeah.
It's so the causality of us is written in the very fabric of the materials that we use. So I don't think I make sustainable work, but I'm thinking about ideas of time, sort of Long View, which is a book. Actually, it's a Long View. It's a book by Richard Fisher, and he addresses this in his book in a much more articulate way about thinking about more long-term planning. And there's also the Long Time Academy, which is an amazing podcast, which looks at donut economics and all these different perspectives about generational thinking about three generations ahead of you. Like, what is the impact of what I'm doing now on those three people and the three generations behind you? So you're in the middle. So yeah. All these sort of things, those are the things I'm sort of thinking about. So art makes me a nicer person. I'm more empathetic to the world around me because I'm slower and I can see things. So I feel like that's how I, you know, I go into the world trying to be that person. Yeah.
It just dawned on me that your work is mostly limited in color.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about coal.
Yeah. Black and white. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's definitely not wasted on me because I think about that all the time because it's, and my dad, he was a coal miner, but then when we moved back to the UK, he worked at Armitage Shanks, who make toilets, right? Yeah. So he was working with porcelain, which is like a white material. Yeah. So this sort of idea of black and white material has sort of been around me the whole time. And where I lived in South Africa, it was a really, you know, it was just like slag heaps everywhere, you know, like waste coal. It was just outside Johannesburg, a place called Witbank. And so that was really, you know, maybe that's all subconscious, you know, in my way. But limiting colour for me is always just, it's about being quiet. And I think, you know, the world is very full of colour and of noise. And so when I'm making my work, it's really just a resting space. So I really try and limit everything to it. So it is literally just about the mark. So it is just about like a meditation, really. Mm. It is about just reducing all the noise of the outside and just limiting it to this sort of mark making. Yeah. So I love colour. I absolutely love colour. But when it comes to my work, and black is a colour, white is a colour.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. We're talking about, No, absolutely. I'm coming back. I want to go back to craftsmanship.
Okay.
Because I'm interested to know how you would define craftsmanship.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a certain knowledge. Yeah, and I think that comes with time. So I definitely do, you know, I have a material knowledge because I've been doing something for a long time. So I think it is really down to knowledge of material and process. I really do think that is, and that comes with time again. And I think you can, you know, digital can be crafted. You can be very good at digital craft. I don't think it limits it just to the analog. I think there are different types of craft out there. But for me, yeah, it is about, I know how to do it, and it comes with a certain knowing. And I think that maybe it's very different to maybe someone who practices textiles. You know, there are lots of artists who might just dabble in a bit of textiles, but don't really know it. And I think I know the material, like I know textiles, I know the wool, I know the cotton, I know exactly how it's going to be. And that for me sort of embodies craft, is this sort of knowledge you've acquired over time. And it becomes sort of, it's sort of embedded in your hands already. It's sort of implicit. It's there, the tacit knowledge of something. It's written into your body already, and that only comes with time. I mean, I had never done embroidery until I was 20. I didn't grow up in a family of crafters or people making all the time. Although my dad was an apprentice craftsman in mining, which I really like, because I felt like, okay, he was a craftsman using his hands, working with a black material. And then here I am using cotton, I mean, a softer material. But I thought that was really nice that there was sort of a crossover there, that we were both sort of men using our hands, this idea of labor. I mean, obviously, again, I had the luxury of not having to go down a coal mine, which I think is a luxury in itself. Like, society has slightly changed.
Sure.
That, you know, we no longer need to do that sort of work, although people still do it, obviously, but I didn't need to go to do that. Yeah.
Tell me a bit about the materials you use. So you've spoken about cotton and wool. Are they specific cottons and specific wools, or are they British wool?
Yeah. So I think the cotton is not British. I think it's, I get it. I don't know. Actually, this is when I think, oh God, I'm not sustainable. This is when I get like sustainability conscious and I get like a bit nervous about telling it. But I think it's just a basic black cotton. There's nothing fancy about it. It's like off the shelf. Right. I mean, that's why I like it. It's, again, it's that's what I love about textiles in general. It's very democratic. it's an accessible medium
yeah.
that people can do. And then the wool is British, so it is, it's from Bradford, and I use another brand as well, but they're all in sort of Yorkshire, which is sort of the history really of wool. It comes from Yorkshire, but also of Scotland. So a lot of my family used to work in the wool mills as well. So again, there's a really interesting idea of the material and the fact that I landed on coal as being, wool as being a material that I use, but it was really about the quality of the wool and the relationship between the cotton and the wool. And I use different types of wool, so different thicknesses, different weights. Each of them has their own different characteristic and I can do different things with them. But I sort of pretty landed on it. It took me about 3 years to find the material that I really, really like, but I'm not limited to that at all. And I've done other things. It's just the one that becomes more visible.
Yeah. Interesting. Somebody told me today that apparently cotton can be grown in colours.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I mean, I have no idea. Yeah,
I mean, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I think, you know, black cotton is very processed. It's a very processed material. So, you know, I think about that a lot as well, but I only use a very small, you know, I don't use a lot of it. You know, it's very, you know, one spool lasts me a very long time, like a year. So I'm not churning.
Oh, wow.
You know, I'm really not churning out stuff. So I don't feel guilty at all about like the work that I make.
Can I touch this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Go for it.
I just wanted to see that.
And the back is incredible. Yeah, wow. I love the back of it.
Yeah, we'll get some shots. And so this is hand done as well.
Yeah, yeah. This is a different one I'm sort of working on at the moment.
Yeah, I apparently cotton seeds. Some of them in Brazil are pre-coloured.
Right. It wouldn't surprise me because like genetics.
Not, yeah, you know, it's
yeah,
exactly.
It would be, that would be transformative, I think, for fashion industry because it would reduce the need for dyeing and waste and like water consumption, things like that. So, I mean, I'm not sure how I feel about genetically altering cotton plants, but in some respects, those are the sort of things that we need to do to change the system. Mm. But I would always say, I'm trying... Yeah, when it comes to, I mean, I just don't consume textiles as much as fashion brands, you know. I'm just never going to be able to do it like that. So I'm sort of conscious in other ways about how I consume textiles. Yeah. So I think secondhand is slightly better or, you know, buying stuff which is like really well made and you can see where it comes from.
Would you ever do this on, would you ever do the embroidery on... textiles you find, or do you always use, I suppose, virgin wool, so to speak?
I have done it on textiles that I've. Yeah, I mean, this is not all of my work. You know, 20 years, so it's like there's more work, and I've definitely found things off the street or recycled fabrics that I've used, and so I would. Yeah, I don't think I'm. Yeah, I don't limit myself just. For the wool, I know exactly what it does, but that's the comfort of it is that I know exactly what I'm going to get out of it. You know, it really does what I want it to do. And these are sort of relatively new experimentations. The black wool is very new because it's much harder to sort of work on. But at the moment, it could be other things as well. Like I'm really interested in sort of vintage papers. So these are all papers which I sort of source from shops or like eBay and things like that. So. There's potential in really old material and renew it. And actually the sort of the checkered piece up there is all waste material, which is like leftover work from all the work that I've made over the last 20 years. So I've got two buckets, so one full of white wool and one full of black. And so I'm making that, and that's a direct response to not trying to buy some fabric for a bit. So using what I've got out the back, which is very buzzy at the moment, like using all your waste materials and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which is, again, it's not my practice. I'm not like reusing waste materials, but I'm getting you to appreciate the sort of the everyday again. Yeah.
There's no tech really anywhere in your studio, or not much that I see. Do you use a lot of tech or?
Yeah, I mean, the computer is really important to everything I do.
Right.
So I use, you know, Photoshop, Illustrator.
Oh, okay.
I have a heat press to transfer sort of design. So some of the objects that I make are, like the grids and the patterns I sort of draw on Illustrator and then they're transferred onto the fabric through heat press. So that's a way that I use sort of, and so I wanted to speed up other processes. That's why I have a sewing machine and all these sort of things. But it always, the bit that I crave is the hand process. That's the bit that I find is the true me.
Yeah.
Although I'm trying to sort of break out of that because it's just, it's very slow, which is great, but not all the time. Yeah.
And do you do machine embroidery then?
I don't. I mean, I literally, yesterday was the first time I used the machine in about 15 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. Just to join pieces together. And I would never do it. It's a different outcome and a different process for me. But, I'm not against technology at all. And I think it's a really wonderful thing to use in the right way. And I have, I have a lot of students who use AI with their work. And I think, technology as a collaboration, as I mentioned before, I do think there's a certain craft to digital technologies, 3D printing, all these things. They require a lot of, research and knowledge and, craft thinking behind all of that. So yeah, I'm not a Luddite, I'm not opposed to technology at all. And it's a vital part of my business.
Yeah.
Of me as an artist recording and then drawing. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's different skills, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, there's discussions about, if a machine can produce something without any fault and it's a perfect thing, it can still be luxury.
Yeah, and people are now trying to program in imperfections.
Yeah.
So they get the hand effect or something. So it's, yeah, I mean, I'm not, yeah, I mean, I really, for me, it is about, I think I've used this on a podcast before, the majesty of the hand, right? The sort of the magic of the hand. And I think that's, that sort of innate desire to want to create. Like, I really just want to make stuff.
Yeah.
And it's very self-indulgent. I think that, and then sometimes I think, oh, what a luxury to be an artist making in the world. But like, it's not like I have to do it. Like, it's like, I just sit there and think about it. And other people do other things that they have to do.
Yeah.
Just I happen to want to make stuff and create and to find things. So yeah,
I mean that's an interesting point, because so many artists, Jeff Koons, Damien Hirst, Murakami. I mean, they've just got factories.
Yeah.
Warhol.
Factory art. Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about that. Especially sort of the dot paintings, and I don't want to get in trouble for it. But I mean, a lot of people who have big studios, I would say a lot of artists nowadays, fine artists, are collaborators. So they will collaborate with scientists or fabricators. And I think that's fine. I've made stuff with fabricators before. But I'll always make my work, because that's the bit I love the most. I'd rather outsource the accounts and tax and all that stuff. All boring admin stuff. And I want to make, but sometimes it's like you have ambition to create different work, and then you do need to work with a team of people. But I'm not interested in, selling 1,000 prints off and getting someone else to make it. Like, I really, for me, that's the bit I want to, and I've got no desire to, for me, when you talk about sustainability, it was just to sustain a normal life, right?
Yeah.
I have no aspirations to, I'd like to have a little bit of money or more money. Just have some money, but not I don't aspire to, and I don't think I ever will, because it's that's just my way. I'm happiest when I'm making work in my studio.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want anyone else to steal that off me,
I find that slightly weird that, these guys don't produce the work themselves.
Mm. That's such a different world, I think. And I think a lot of people do that, and I think it's the accepted, norm now. There are lots of artists that don't, of course, but
sure.
It's you can become more ambitious, and you can just churn work out. It's like huge, monumental work. So I think that's the benefit of having a studio of people working with you, is that you have people to help realize your ideas. But then that becomes even harder to manage. I mean, that's just my worst nightmare, like having to worry about employing 20 people, and it just becomes a bigger machine, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you can, some people get it and they do it and they're able to do it.
And it's amazing.
And it's,
I mean, talking about the touch of the hand, mm-hmm. is, for me, that's really important in luxury.
Yeah.
You can get a machine to do it and it will be perfect, or built-in imperfection, or you can get a group of people in your studio making the art. But if I'm buying something from an artist, I want it to be from the artist's hand.
From the artist, yeah. But I think that is, again, I'm not really necessarily part of that art market world. So sure. It's a different thing where it's like a lot of sort of hedging on bits of art, and, you know, it's about generating value, or the sort of, it's where you sink your money, right, into these sort of pieces. Whereas yeah. I'm just not at that level, I think, yeah. or it's not where my work is sort of aimed towards. Mine is just, is quite honest, I think. I'm just, you know, sitting quietly, stitching, trying to, you know, describe the world. Yeah.
How do you start a piece?
Definitely it starts, I'm usually, as I'm making a piece of work, I'm usually thinking about the next piece of work. So, starting the work, it just starts with an idea, or it starts with an image, or I use a lot of sort of grid, circle, squares, and that becomes the framework. So I'm really interested in generating pattern. I'm a complete pattern finder. So, you know, work just starts because it's a heavily researched project. Like the coal project, for instance, I didn't start making for a year. That started with research. So that started with reading, looking, you know, investigation, lots of documents. Whereas some work is very just direct. I start stitching and I'm filling a circle, and it can be like that. So different works, different projects, they require different ways of starting and thinking about work. But a lot of it's in my head, and I draw a little sketch, and then I might come back to that sketch later on. But I've learned the hard way is like not to jump straight into a piece of work and to do the sort of testing and speaking of the idea over and over again, because it can, like the first idea sometimes is usually the best, but sometimes it can be the wrong idea. And so you need to sort of keep working at it. I'm not sure if that's a roundabout answer. I don't think it's always really clear how I really start a work, but there are different projects require different ways of approaching it. Yeah.
I'm intrigued by the Japan thing. How did you get interested in Japan and Japanese art and design? And
I think maybe it's more of an Eastern sort of philosophy. I think maybe I'm sort of interested in Zen, you know, how you deal with space. I think there's lots of really beautiful things like that. And I think maybe it's inspired by my love of like Agnes Martin and how she talks about sort of Eastern philosophy and how that sort of integrates with her work. So I think that was really it. And it is an aesthetic thing. There is something really beautiful about balance, form, composition, about negative space. You know, sometimes it's like the space, the sort of the negative space, what you leave out can say something. And a lot of the work that I make is about forming space. So I'm making a space by filling a space. So you get these sort of really abstract patterns. So that's the sort of the sense of it. It is to do with really about this idea of time as well. I think that's really the sort of essence of it, that this idea of the sort of fragility of life and living in the sort of present moment, and that respect for change, and that things change in cycles. Yeah.
How does that manifest itself in your work then? Can you point to?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's like a literal thing, but it's things that I'm thinking about, definitely. And I think definitely in terms of space, and about, there's this concept within Japanese sort of culture, I think it's in Chinese culture as well, Zen, definitely, about Ma, which is like MA, which is about sort of negative space. But it also, that is also about a space that is created through making. So when I'm making, I'm creating space, drawing space, but I'm also, there's a physical space in the sense, but also there's a mental space. And so that Ma also relates to something which is very specific to the artist. A lot of musicians have this sort of moment where it's an internal space that you're creating as well. So it's not like a literal transformation of that, but it's an idea that I'm thinking about. It's a thing which is very personal to me that I inhabit. And I do that in sort of meditation as well. It's just to be. So in my work, I'm just being. Which is a really nice thing to be able to do, yeah.
You've spoken also about teaching. Mm-hmm. How important is kind of sharing your knowledge and sharing, how you see things with others?
I think it's important. I think more and more as I've got older, I want to be able to share that perspective and this idea of material knowledge and give people the tools in order to make sense of the world. And I think that is a really great way that makes art or makes what I'm doing democratic and accessible, because then people can experience what I'm sort of thinking or doing. And that is the really that is the beauty of embroidery, because it's such an international language, and it's very convivial. You can talk. It crosses borders. You know, everyone has got the language of textiles in them, you know, in their cultures. So they might not speak the same language, but you can speak through making. I think, again, the sort of universality of that is really powerful. But teaching for me is really important, especially, you know, I teach, you know, all types of people. I teach at MA level, which I think is really important to sort of nurture the sort of future landscape of textiles and art in general, art and design. I think it's really important to who we are, culture. Not always able to sort of measure that in monetary value at all, because I think it has a bigger impact culturally, well-being of people, right? Even though it might not seem important above other things like food and housing and, you know, social care, but I think art is sort of caring. So that, I think that's really important, but also just like for people just to take a step off the highway, you know, a little bit. Like workshops that I'm sort of teaching are, again, I worry about the workshops that I teach, because they're not always accessible price points, you know, because I've still got to make a living. And so, again, it's sort of, that is aimed at a slightly higher market, I would say. But, you know, through social media and places like that, that's where I aim to sort of be slightly more democratic, although that I would challenge whether social media is democratic as well. So yeah, but it's important to me to share that material knowledge, because I feel like people don't really necessarily have that hand making. A few years ago I did the Cheltenham Science Festival, and we did something called the Make Shack, and I got the kids to stitch DNA helix, and from age 5 to 16, and it was incredible how many 16-year-olds didn't know how to thread a needle or hold the material. And so I feel like there's a real lack of material knowledge, and that has repercussions for how we value material, how we value people's time, how people understand making. You know, it's all connected, and I think, you know, making can really ground. We live in a material world. I think a very famous singer said that, right? With blonde hair. So it's really important. It's really important that we understand how things are made, especially textiles, because it's such a damaging material, right? Even though it sort of swaddles us and it comforts us and we sleep in it and we wear it, it's the architecture of our life, clothes, right? But a lot of people don't fully understand simple things like how to put a button on, or, you know, understand how things are constructed, or the labor, the time that it takes to make something. And so in a workshop, I'm trying to get people to really appreciate that.
Yeah. And there's luxury in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not aware, you know, I'm very aware of that. Again, it's like sort of a lot of the things I'm sort of preaching to people who have got the luxury to think in that way. Like my mom would have been down at Primark getting cheap jeans because she's got no money to clothe the kids. So I'm very aware, like there is a need for cheaper products or materials or things in life, but it's very skewed. I'm not sure if I have the complete correct answer to solve that at all, but it does come from sort of knowledge, but it's a structural reform right from the top almost, and sort of pressure from consumers.
Yeah, but there's a luxury in learning. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, kids who might not know how to thread a needle.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was growing up, and probably when you were as well, I mean, you know, there was sewing at school. You know, things like that were, because there wasn't all this tech around, weren't always on social media, on phones or laptops or games or whatever they might have been. So there was a very different world that we inhabited.
Yeah.
Now there seems to be less, probably less interest in, you know, feeling material.
Yeah,
looking at how things are made.
And I think that has to do with, it's down to politics again. It's down to the educational system where we value other subjects over other things. It's, as a scientist or an engineer, it's really important to understand materials, to learn dexterity, to learn how to be a surgeon. You need to really know, you know, learning sewing can really help you do that, to understand how to use your hands, to feel the weight of a piece of silk could be really vital to you. Working with a robotic arm, doing a very intense microsurgery on someone's heart valve, or, you know, so there are parallels between practice. But the thing is, we don't see that, and that comes from, that comes from education. and how we value it, and it has to again start from the top down, sort of our educational response. And I think my hope is that, of course, you know, I grew up in 90, so I was at school in 93 94 95 96 97 okay 98 99 Labour, New Labour, and it was really prioritized, they really prioritized art, and I feel like I'm a product of that, right? Because art was seen as a valuable thing, and I feel like that has been definitely lost, and we can see that now. And so if it's not taught at a very early age, of course we're going to end up with people who don't really understand materials, or then don't have respect for clothes or other products, or you can buy a cheap one and throw it away. Yeah, again, it's really a really complex thing, but I think education is really, really important. And I think a workshop, which is what I'm teaching to luxury, maybe is a luxury at a sort of premium price point, I'm not going to solve that problem. It needs to start right at the beginning. My mom was always mending things at home. Yeah. You know, you'd mend something. You wouldn't buy something else because you didn't have money to buy another thing. And definitely my gran, and they would be knitting jumpers, or, you know, because it wasn't just, they weren't doing it to enjoy it. They were like, oh, this is really useful because I can make you a piece of clothing, right? Yeah. Whereas I feel like it's very different. Different now.
But luxury is about mending. It is, you know, it's not, and I use this phrase, I think probably in every single conversation I have, I use this reference, is that I met Olga Berluti, mm-hmm. And she, for much of the conversation I had with her, much of what she was saying is that the best pair of shoes is not the new pair of shoes. It's the pair of shoes that you've worn for years and you keep fixing.
Yeah, and it shapes you. Yeah. It sort of fits your shoe. It fits your foot correctly. Yeah, I think we just don't mend things. I've got a pair of trainers that I've sort of mended on the side where my sort of hot toes have come out on the side. I think there's something, it's a war, you know it, and the clothes know you. So I think, definitely... the best item of clothing you have is the one, or the most sustainable item. And I feel really bad because I can't remember her name, but she runs, she's part of Aesthetica Fashion. The best item of clothing that you have is the one already in your wardrobe. Mm. So that is her statement. And I feel really bad also, I think her name is. Those things, all the things that you have like that. But there's just this constant cycle of sort of consumerism. I mean, that's the world we live in, right? We're sort of taught that from a very early age to sort of consume. And that's why I sort of left retail, because I felt like I was never doing a good job unless the KPIs matched. So I could do a really good job and it would look really good. But unless the KPIs matched and we sold more stuff, then it wasn't a success. And I thought that's really how you can measure success, just in how many units you've sold. And I thought, it's got to be more than that, right? Mm. It has to be about more than that.
Sure. You know,
how many black stretch pants has Adidas sold this month? Great, it's a bestseller we've sold. But, you know, in the warehouse, there's 100,000 of them. And it's like, and then the next season, it's the same thing over and over again. So I think that is broken, that sort of system, I think, yeah.
So what's next for you?
Yeah, maybe even slower sort of making ahead of me. I have a show next year with Make House and Worth. So I'm working on a new body of work for that. And then I've got a show actually this autumn with Future Heritage, which is run by Corinne Julius, which will be at the Chelsea Harbour, where I'm making a new series of works for that. But that's it really, I think, yeah. Taking stock, reevaluating, trying to find time just to be in the studio.
Great. What is your luxury?
I think maybe the studio is quite a luxury. I think, and I also think maybe, I'm not going to say my art is a luxury because that is just part of who I am. But I think, this space is a real luxury because it's not something that everyone else has. It's very special to me. I do think a studio is wherever you are. I mean, an artist said that, Phila de Barlow. She said, you don't need a studio. The studio is wherever your head is at. And I do think that, but I think to have a space of my own, which is away from everything else, you know, from the domestic, then this is, yeah. So this feels like a luxury to me, yeah.
Richard McBettis, thank you so much for joining us on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.
Great. No, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you to Richard And thank you to you for listening and or watching. And thank you to our sponsors, Intellect Books. And don't forget, you can catch up with all previous episodes of the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast on your favorite platform. We look forward to seeing you again on the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast.